Hi, and welcome. This is Dave. I hope you're each doing great. I'm eager to hear any discussion or questions about the first couple of seminars. You're half as smart as you're going to be, and we have two remaining seminars on mindset mastery and neuromarketing. So any questions or thoughts or reflections about the first two? How are you finding the application of these for what you're doing? Anyone, I know a number of you are on the line. I know some are listening to this in the recording because it's a very different time zone, a couple of different continents. But I know those of you who are live, I'd really love to hear from you. And those of you who listen to it later, shoot me an email. And I appreciate the emails and the kind words I've received. Thoughts and questions, anyone? Or any kind of feedback? Anyone? Well, I will move into the material then.
That means we're okay, David.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Who is this?
It's Simon from New Zealand.
Welcome. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you, David.
Super. Well, you have done a stretch with the time zone, so I appreciate you being there live time.
You're welcome.
Okay. Any you know, final call for thoughts, questions, reflections from anyone? Okay, hold on. I'd like to start the mindset mastery development with a quiz. Carnegie Mellon University did a large study to determine the major factor for professionals earning the trust of others. Which do you think was most important for a spectrum of professionals earning trust? An established, proven expert? Confidence of the professional? Demonstrated current expertise? Or reputation? I'll come back to that. When we talk about mindset, I'm really referring to a set of assumptions and beliefs that determines how we perceive, process, and behave. It's analogous to the software program of each state of mind. Our mindsets consciously and unconsciously then determine our choices. Elite athletes, for example, know how to get themselves in an optimum state before going on the court or field and how to sustain it. Masterful actors, speakers, storytellers do as well. Getting in state is a combination of mental, emotional, and physical. A significant persuasion and leadership competency is self-regulation and self-management. Knowing your own skills and deploying them effectively in a mindset specifically matched to the task. So I want to talk first about some mindset strategies of successful persuasion. Consider this. How do you get a potential prospect you may not know or don't even see in a state of mind to consider your service or your product? Whatever meaning you associate to a stimulus determines behavior. In other words, state always comes first, and then strategy and story. To persuade, know and communicate the emotional reasons to, for example, buy now, and then the logical reasons to buy now. So the next time you want to get someone on board with your idea or service, simply tell a story where you spell out the best outcome. We know now from the mind and brain sciences that storytelling is the most powerful way to plant ideas into someone's mind. Stories are how we make sense of things and how we remember. When we're being told an effective story, it activates not only the language processing areas, but also the areas used in experiencing the events of the story. Someone tells us how delicious a peach is, our sensory cortex lights up. when it's about emotion, our right neocortex gets active. When the story characters grab objects, our motor neurons activate. When the character observes a scene, vision-related neurons fire. A story puts our whole brain to work. And stories affect us mentally as well as physically. Ann Crindle at the Dartmouth Brain Lab showed how viewers' brains resonated with the specific emotion enacted on the screen. When the central character was angry, the viewer's brain registered anger as well. When the scene was sad, the viewer's brains corresponded. Whenever we feel disgust, that brain region, the anterior insula, fires. We sense the other person's intentions and imagine what an experience means in his or her mind. And this can occur just as well by telephone. And I do it regularly with my mentor coaching clients because I work solely by telephone. Intuition and this kind of experience works just as well as face-to-face. Mindsight, our innate ability to see into each other's minds, relies on attunement of empathic resonance with someone else's subjective experience. The teller's state of mind and intention is key to the listener's reception. For example, if we sense the other person is phony or distracted, we automatically distance or tune out. When someone genuinely attunes, it enhances the inclination to relax and feel more trusting. This means that getting in state needs to be before you engage your reader or listener. Relax your body. Control your breath. Get solidly grounded to access the optimum state of mind for a particular task. There's about 35-minute webinar on the homepage of my website, mentorpath.com, on master states of mind. There's a bit more elaboration in some other areas than we're covering in this seminar, so it's something that you may find of interest. The primary reason to get in state is to concentrate your energy on a full, undisturbed immersion in your engagement. People like, respect, and trust and are influenced by those who have the ability to remain calm and thoughtful. This default setting to remain centered and grounded no matter what becomes an essential success paradigm. Like any state of mind, it's contagious. Amygdala to amygdala, midbrain to midbrain. Regulating your own state of mind in a sustained way is the most effective influence on someone else to do the same. Here are four basic mindset tools of persuasion. These four principles we're going to discuss the remainder of this seminar. And the context always is authenticity. The most valuable gift you have to offer is yourself. These are the four that we're going to discuss. Rapport. For a long-term impact, establish authentic caring and emotional investment. Ask what you can do for them. Highlight mutual interest. Tell a story that solves a challenge. Maybe even give an authentic compliment. Two, ask questions. Redirect the focus from problems to possibilities. The essence of appreciative inquiry. Move to a mindset of openness and exploration. And remember, the focus determines the state of mind. Paint a picture of a positive outcome. When people imagine, it becomes real for them. Three, personal congruity. What you say verbally and non-verbally need to match. And remember this, the person who feels the most certain is the greatest influencer. And finally, state management of yourself and to impact emotions and state of mind of the prospect. Let's look at these four in an applied way now. First, the difference between success and failure. This is overly simplistic, but the two most important determinants of success are beliefs and state management. First, beliefs. A belief is the blueprint, the software of the unconscious mind. Focus aligns the energy field of the brain, as we've talked about before, and repeated focus rewires the brain. This is the way belief becomes an anatomical reality. Beliefs then determine what we will or won't do. What we believe, the meaning we feel certain will come from situations, determines how we behave and what we'll do. Social neuroscientists show us that we have to believe in what we're selling or we won't sell. So, how do you create a new belief? The oak sleeps in the acorn. Success comes to those who become success conscious. Failure enhances when there's focus on the negative, on problems. The only known method of voluntary conscious development of belief is repetition of affirmations to your unconscious. We come to believe what we repeat to ourselves, whether it's true or false. If a lie is repeated, it ultimately is experienced as the truth, and the teller even ultimately can't tell the difference. This neuroscience principle emphasizes the need and power of positive focus. Visions are the seedlings of reality. If you can't see significant wealth in your imagination, in your vision, you won't see it in your bank account. Systematic, repeated visualization rewires the brain. Affirmations are simply stories that support the visualizations to revise mind software. You're not ready for something until you believe you can acquire it. Belief can be inscribed by affirmation or repeated instructions to the unconscious mind. Repetition of affirmations to your unconscious mind is a powerful method of voluntary development of belief. Any thought that is repeatedly passed on to the unconscious mind is finally accepted. This is as true for wealth accumulation as it is for other consistent repetitions, even such as crime. So, if we look at it, there are basically a couple of types of beliefs. One is global beliefs, like life is, people are, I am, you know, fill in the blank. Each affects the way we look at and interpret things and their meanings. Another type of belief are rules, cause and effect beliefs. If, then, if this, then that. We have brain algorithms of behavior, emotional, and attachment patterns that couple cues and responses. So, being grounded and centered, reflecting on this, can help us become aware of attachment patterns and behavior patterns. And in a very simple way of saying it, if it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. But the first step is recognition by self-reflection. People will say yes much more readily to your belief than to your information or technical sales skills. They come to believe what you believe. So the first sale is to yourself. Selling is a transference of emotion. You must feel certain to make someone believe. The primary way you convince someone else is if you're convinced. You will transfer whatever state of mind you're in from doubt to confidence. A second difference between success and failure, state management. An everyday application of this. Recognize and understand emotional couplings. Regardless of how logical we think we are, our first register of a new stimulus is emotional. Any new input goes directly to the amygdala in the midbrain. Then the hippocampus, also in the midbrain, attaches meaning. This is the site of the unconscious. That's where meaning's attached. Then it goes to the forebrain to process consciously and intellectually, to make logical sense. Notice how the last step is to make it conscious and logical. Decisions are already made at a midbrain level. Neuroeconomics labs have shown some amazing things. We even can solve puzzles seconds before we're aware that we have solved them. And I want to highlight again, the hippocampus is the primary location of the unconscious where meanings are attached. This is why what someone associates to you, your brand, your company is so important. Our state of mind, the software package, determines the meaning we attach to a stimulus, and the meaning attached determines the behavior. Each state of mind is like a software program. It contains its own beliefs, associations, and set of experiences. For example, you're at home relaxing after dinner with your partner, having a glass of wine, a great conversation. There's a noise in your backyard. You most likely don't notice it, or if you do, you dismiss it. Next evening, you're home alone, just after watching Criminal Minds. It's Wednesday evening, by the way. And you hear the same noise. You're alert to it, vigilant. You check it out. Same stimulus, the state of mind determines the meaning attached. Everything at the lower emotional brain and the midbrain are unconscious processes. The emotional activation registers before cognitive areas of the brain come into play to assess options. And, as I've mentioned, neuroeconomics research shows that we make purchase decisions, for example, up to 10 seconds before we're even consciously aware of them. Once we unconsciously make a commitment to a yes or to a no decision, these lower brain structures send the conscious mind on a mission to gather all the logical reasons to support that decision. Then we cherry-pick data to support that pre-selected belief. We find something logical and sensible for it to light on, even if it's not an accurate cause and effect. The rationalization becomes a confirmation bias. We inhabit the story we want to believe. The failure to notice contradictory data becomes an inattention blindness. We simply don't pay attention to it. When we make a choice, we couple memory from past experiences with the best guesses of a likely future. Our lives are determined by our choices. Those choices are informed by what we focus on and shaped by the meaning that we attribute. So the part of the brain that anticipates a pleasant outcome, the pleasure center, the nucleus accumbens, activates a buy decision. A don't buy decision originates in a different part of the brain, the insula. It's an area involved in anticipating pain. These anticipatory emotions bias as well as drive decision making. Think about an application here. Credit card companies decouple buying, the activation of the pleasure center, and paying, the activation of the pain center in the brain. The pleasure of the purchase is segmented from the pain of future payment. This segmentation renders repayment a future abstraction. Our optimism bias even suggests we'll probably have more money later, or at the very least, my dear self, tomorrow is another day. Now, the application here may be that it's hard to save because of the way our minds work and our brains are wired. It's hard to resist the immediate pleasure of buying. Making and spending money both activate the pleasure center of the brain, mediated by dopamine. And it's difficult to substitute a theory like future need or long-term saving or retirement for the immediate payoff. So the three most common reasons people fail at doing what they want to do. One, not enough compelling reasons. Two, limiting belief systems. Three, inability to consistently manage states of mind. So let's look a little more closely at regulating states of mind. Your state of mind, the particular software program you use, determines the meaning you attach to a stimulus. The meaning you attach then determines your behavior. There are two primary ways to regulate your state of mind. physiology, and focus. Physiology is how you use your body to change your body, your biochemistry, to change your state of mind. So the simple tools here may be a relaxation or simple deep breathing or even a brief meditation. And the second, focus, what and how you direct conscious attention. From quantum physics and brain science, you get what you focus on, not what you want. Focus aligns your energy field. What you focus on, what you pay attention to, determines your state of mind. Our minds work by consistently and consciously selecting the one focus that we want to register at any moment. By holding this one thing in awareness, we give relative inattention to everything else. This means that we have an immediacy bias. We assign undue weight to whatever we pay attention to at this moment. The questions we ask ourselves determine what we focus on. Questions direct the focus and, therefore, determine the state we're in. For example, if you have an habitual feeling you don't like, it can come from a repeated focus and negative questions. Why does this always happen to me? Why am I overweight? The focus is on something negative. The quality of your life can be influenced by the quality of the questions you ask daily. Change the questions. Ask a better question. We're always asking questions from the moment we wake up, although we may not be aware of them. If we began the day by immediately asking, what could go wrong today? We've already begun a scenario that establishes a negative state of mind, and that determines the engagement with the initial part of the day. Another bad question, can I really do this? Remember, your brain follows your focus, whether that's positive or negative. So ask questions that habitually empower you. Ask a better question. Instead of what can go wrong today, ask perhaps, what will I create today that will be more powerful than I've ever dreamed of and have fun doing it? Instead of, why am I overweight, what can I do today for better nutrition and physical shape? I was asked to do a workshop at a Vistage group recently. The Vistage chair, a buddy of mine, indicated that two of her members, one a CEO and another a business owner, each had experienced challenging incidents at their companies. One involved an accident with a loss of life. Both created stress in the executives and the organization as well that remained unresolved. I discussed with them how exactly what we just talked about, how we're always asking ourselves questions even if we wake up before we're consciously aware of the process. And those questions boot up a mindset that initiates the engagement with the day. Worry or negative questions or even stubbing your toe as you get up can launch the first few hours in a negative way. And both of these executives were aware of questions they were asking themselves as soon as they woke up. What's going to go wrong today? So as part of our collaboration, I suggested this exercise. Before you go to bed, write down three questions that would create a positive, powerful state of mind. As soon as you wake up in the morning, before your feet even touch the floor, take that paper and answer those questions. Feel the answer to each of the three questions to put you in an empowered, positive state. The feedback I got, in less than 1 week, both executives created a positive turnaround in focus, attitude, and engagement for themselves and their organizations. I'm going to apply this to persuasion, neuroscience, and influence psychology in just a moment. I want to give you one more example of how you get what you focus on, not what you want. The great aerialist Carl Wallenda, the patriarch of the Flying Wallendas, had performed death-defying feats on the high wire for more than 50 years. Still at the age of 71, Wallenda's capacity for focus on his intention was legendary. His concentration on success became a self-fulfilling prophecy for over five decades of triumph on the high wire. What you focus on grows. Wallenda's wife indicated that he had been a bit anxious, maybe just preoccupied, the day before taking the wire, a tightrope, in San Juan, Puerto Rico. For the first time in all the years she'd known him, he focused on the risk of falling. He personally supervised the attachment of the guy wires, which he had never done before. During the performance, he tragically fell to his death. You get what you focus on. Asking effective questions determines a state of mind. This is your power of focus. Ask habitual questions that empower you. The best mentors, leaders, and teachers are the ones who ask the best questions to get us to use our own resources. First application, to yourself. Next, to your client, in that order. The difference between a professional and an amateur, between massive success or less, is the ability to manage your state of mind, to achieve and sustain a peak performance state. Here's the mindset formula for optimizing persuasion. Find the challenge or problem, the deep want or interest that is unfulfilled in your client. Show them how to solve the problem or meet the challenge. Associate positive consequences if they do, ideally getting them to do that, and associate negative consequences if they don't, which has occurred in the past most likely. This mindset formula of persuasion associates buying with getting pleasure and not buying with pain. And recall, people will do more to avoid pain than to seek pleasure, risk aversion. This is why the focus on results and consequences becomes more effective. The primary reason we do what we do is how we imagine we're going to feel when we do it. Think about that, and think if that's true for you. The primary reason we do what we do is how we imagine we're going to feel when we do it. The persuasion process is centered on getting the prospect to clearly associate the most desired state or feeling with your product or service for that prospect. The three most basic reasons someone fails to persuade. First, not consistently managing mindset. This ability to manage a state of mind is often the difference between success and failure. And again, first in you, then in the client. No compelling purpose during a challenging time. And third, limiting beliefs like, I don't think it'll really work. I've tried it before. I've tried everything and nothing works. Of the insights that neuroscience brings to the business world, one of the most powerful is the ability to understand how a consumer connects with various concepts about your brand at an unconscious level. It is crucial, in my view, important to have a clear and exact understanding of the individual elements that make up the existing unconscious perceptions of a product or service. We're going to talk a good deal more about that in the next seminar on neuromarketing, because that's basically what neuromarketing is. People love people who change their state. That's why entertainers are paid so much more than educators. Pro athletes, way more than service people. We want to be around people who change our state for the better. So let's apply that now to your business. Selling is transferring emotion. Your state of mind will have emotional contagion. Manage your state because it induces a state in others. Think about that from anyone you've bought something from. Think about that from any performance, from any presentation, from any teacher you've ever been influenced by. You associate positive or negative emotions and states to your product or service, then your prospect does too. If you're not in a peak state, such as maybe having a down feeling or a lesser expectation, that will also be emotionally contagious. authentic energy is contagious. When your story truly excites you and you let that excitement show, it will be infectious to prospects. Your authenticity of genuine enthusiasm and conviction will resonate with prospects. Now, consider this question. Why can someone who begins at a peak state with a prospect come across as hyper or like a typical salesperson and turn the prospect off? And create a response like an eye roll at an over-the-top, off-the-wall spiel that turns the listener off by the first sentence? The answer? They don't begin where the prospect is. Remember, the first thing we do with the prospect is to empathically resonate, become attuned, and find a way to communicate that experience. The result is a co-creation of a common ground, a reciprocal connection. Then the client or prospect will go together someplace new with you to follow your lead. You co-create a state that's a mutual journey, a process to arrive step by step at the same place. I touched on this initially, and I want to mention it again. Many years ago when I was practicing psychoanalysis, I had a very succinct and powerful lesson about this from a very accomplished woman executive. I offered her an interpretation that I thought was a particular insight. She paused, and remember what she said. She rose up on one elbow, turned around on the analytic couch to look directly at me and say, "No, Kruger, first you have to be with me before I can go someplace new with you." A brilliant, simple synopsis of this principle. It's the principle of every engagement you have with a prospect. So consider these questions for your own reflection. This is between you and you now. How much money, how many prospects have you lost because you haven't been in a peak state in the last 3 months, in the last 3 years? How much has it cost you emotionally, regret, pain, less energy, less money, of not being in a peak state in the last 3 months, in the last 3 years? In the next 10 years, what will it cost you if you don't master this ability? And in the next 10 years, what if you operate at peak state and enjoy the process? Again, selling is a transference of emotion. You associate your state to your product or service. People associate your state to your product or service. People buy a state. State change is activating. So the mindset management principles in summary. State is what you're selling more than a product or service. Selling is influencing the prospect's focus, the value, the benefits, to gain pleasure and avoid pain. Questions determine what we focus on and the state we're in. And the mindset of self-reflection fosters thoughtfulness, depth, and wisdom. So let's look just a little bit more at peak state to match the optimum state of mind to the specific task. Anchor yourself for success. Peak performance comes from being in a peak state. The quickest way to change your state is to change the way that you're using your body to cue that change. Physiology and focus. For example, develop a power cue or gesture that immediately puts you in an optimum state. And remember, your optimum state for some things, such as a presentation, may be to energize yourself and generate optimism. For other things, like working with a client, it may be to get fully centered and grounded. On the other hand, to go to sleep, it may be to relax more effectively. Your gesture and focus phrase will need to match the state you want to enter. I've touched on this before, and I want to expand just a little bit here about confidence being a state of mind. We know from numerous neuroscience studies that emotions and states of mind are contagious by an energy field transfer from amygdala to amygdala, person to person. Einstein referred to this as the unified field theory. He emphasized that we are each a bundle of energy and interact with another person who is also a bundle of energy, and those energy fields intersect and interact. The same with each person and the collective energy field of a group of other people, and it goes both ways. Confident is a state of mind. People naturally associate confidence with expertise. The induction of a shared experience, a mutual influence of energy fields, play a role in our affinity for confident people. Now, the answer, which you know by now, to the Mindset Mastery Quiz, a Carnegie Mellon study, the major factor for professionals earning the trust of others, the confidence of the professional. Simple, confident explanations trump expertise. Mirror neurons and energy fields resonate with another's emotional state and influence behavior. This is important. Confidence has been shown to be more correlated with success than competence or expertise. So at least combine the three. Confidence is what initially engages someone. It is what people will pay you for. Since we know that confidence is a significant predictor and determinant of success, be aware of conscious and unconscious biases. For example, in studies with business school graduates, men initiate salary increases 40% more than women do. And when both ask, women ask for 30% less than men. At Manchester Business School in England, Professor Marilyn Davidson says, I've been doing this for about 7 years, and every year there are massive differences between male and female responses. The male students expect to earn significantly more than the women. And when you look at what the students think they deserve to earn, the differences are huge. We can never earn more in the outside world than we can earn in our own minds. If we earn, for example, 10% more or less than that income thermostat, we may automatically and unconsciously engage in automatic behaviors and patterns to reestablish that status quo, to move the thermostat back to the set point. We have to achieve it in our minds to change the thermostat before we can actually have it in reality. Once something unconscious becomes conscious, it's no longer unconscious. We always present in a manner consistent with our self-concept, more specifically, just as we do in any other role that we play. A self-concept regulates every aspect of our lives. It's the software that drives the behavior. Confidence is a state of mind. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you do, for example, everything except close a sale, or not make a specific professional recommendation to a client about your services and your fee, your self-concept in that area needs to be addressed. The professional must always maintain the initiative. You've never heard other professionals like doctors or attorneys say something wishy-washy at the end of a consultation like, well, do you think it would be helpful for us to work together? The professional makes a specific, confident recommendation. You don't let the guy with a shovel decide how many elephants are in the parade. What's the best time to make a sale? Is it after vacation and you're relaxed? When you have debt, you really need the money? Or after a dry spell? No, times three. The best time to make a sale is right after a sale. Confidence is a state of mind. Sustaining an optimum state is as important as changing a negative state. And consider this question from the prospect's point of view. What is the major thing that holds the prospect back from making a purchase? One of these reasons, usually in this order: fear of making a mistake, concern of not getting value, worry about paying too much, question about not being able to use the product or service. The major thing that holds the salesperson back is the fear of rejection, that the prospect may say no. And remember this statement: of all the things that I will say in this seminar, the major thing that keeps you from getting what you want is your story about why you can't get what you want. Stories can change. Neuroscientists show us that the first few words of a conversation boots up a particular mindset in the listener to process the remainder of the exchange. This is huge, whether you're talking to your adolescent child or your client. A conversation that begins with authoritative, critical, adversarial remarks or perceived as such activates the brain circuitry of fight or flight. This reaction is processed by the cortisol, adrenaline, neurochemical system. This closes down the person for self-protection and results in defensive positions. Now, consider a conversation that begins in a collaborative, collegial mode, activates the brain's neurochemical system of bonding and connection. This induces listening without judgment, to pay full attention, a collaboration. This initial collaborative, trusting response is mediated by oxytocin, the chemical of connection and bonding. This frames the remainder of the sentence and the conversation. The listener feels safe, understood. Trust develops with further collaboration to optimize performance and results. Your opening remark determines whether the prospect will listen to you. It needs to be planned word for word. In the first 10 words, people decide whether they're going to listen to you or not. So, don't begin with, well, here's how I would answer that. You've already used 7 words, you've only got 3 left. All successful sales are based on one factor, a relationship. People don't buy from people they don't like, and people can't sell to people who they don't like. Enthusiasm accounts for more sales closing ability than any other factor. The transfer of enthusiasm changes the state of the other person. Confidence begets enthusiasm. The key to developing an effective engagement is twofold: to know and resonate with the prospect's need, the essential challenge of the prospect, to know your unique proposition, what you do better than anyone else that fits the client's challenge or need. What is unique and special about your product or service in 10 words or less? People won't buy your product because it's as good as everybody else. They'll buy it because it's unique in some way for them. Your key job is to identify that unique advantage that sets you above everyone else and build your brief comments around that. Hint at the result. Plant a seed of the benefit in your first question. Focus on the key benefit that the prospect can enjoy. Not what you've done, not your experience, not how long you've been doing what you're doing, not your credentials. If you ask a question, people are conditioned to respond to the question before they respond to anything else. Make sure your question is focused on the benefit that you bring to their problem. Let's look now at mastery model. Consider your body of work as the process of a creative mindset, a series of experiments that can be interesting, intellectually stimulating, and like solving a puzzle. This mindset is what activates new pathways and neuronal connections in your brain. First, look for models. Find people who are doing business in an innovative and effective way for you to understand the key parts of their business model. Find those who do what you want to do, having success at it, and learn from them, but do it in your way. It has to be your story. For example, a few years ago, when I wanted to offer a mastermind group to the licensed, specialty certified New Life Story Wellness Coaches and New Money Story Mentors I train, I read books about different models, signed up for a teleseminar course, and was mentored by a leading expert. Consistently, one of the most fun things I've done. Two, define the phases of your business. Here's an example sequence. Define a specific target market, a niche. Identify the unique problems or challenges of that target market. What's your story to engage them? Create an initial offering of a service or product that solves that target market's problem. Test the offering with a finite number of ideal participants, perhaps initially even with a focus group. Debrief your test to determine how it could be replicated, what worked and what didn't, and then develop a business plan from your lessons learned and evolve to an ultimate initial offering. Develop a following, your platform, your mailing list from a blog, newsletter, LinkedIn, professional Facebook. Develop a product to sell to the market when your list grows. Test, debrief, continue building services and products, and get feedback. Even consider affiliate partners. What's the next thing you want to add to your body of work? What do you want to create? Name it. Describe it. Who's it for? Describe your audience. Why does it need to get done? Describe the roots of it and how it fits into your body of work. Who will be affected? And what good will happen as the result of your completing it? How are you going to structure it and define a model? When does it need to be done? Set a deadline. And finally, focus on the basics. Give attention to every aspect of your products or services. Great work is built by great basics. Everything you do and produce needs to be totally professional. This includes proofreading and spell checking, even your emails. Deconstruct everything, the specifics of what exactly leads to your success. And as I mentioned, the most sophisticated and practical wisdom I know, if it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. The evidence that we truly understand the pattern of behavior is when we know how to reverse it. Establish boundaries and framework for your work. Schedule, telephone, personal, professional time. Protect your energy. Establish a specific creative container for your work. Use the best tools that you can afford. I learned this from my dad growing up on a farm and ranch. Learn fully how to use those tools, your computer, social and business media. Cultivate your voice. Everything needs to be your story told in your voice. Keep your focus on honoring your work. Listen to feedback. But ultimately, take neither feedback or criticisms or accolades personally and stay focused on your own self-regulation. Use all of it as information. Develop your own intuition, your unique expression, your ideas from your internal point of reference. Punch through the bag. Martial artist teachers emphasize to punch through the bag when they practice jabs and crosses, meaning rather than focusing on hitting the target, which may make your punch weak, set your target a foot behind the bag and aim to hit that. Same applies to your work. How today's goal relates to tomorrow's goal and next year's goal. Plan all the way to the end. Think like a scientist. Keep an open mind about whether what you're doing works or not, or if it could be done better. Evaluate all feedback from an objective perspective. Obtain a full range of feedback from all sources. 360s are great for this. A scientist creates a working hypothesis, tests it, observes with curiosity, asks why, tweaks, retests, observes. And finally, mindset and the circle of persuasion. Imagine your audience is a person you're trying to persuade. To visualize this, I'd like you to take a page and draw a stick figure on that page to represent this person, your particular client. Now, draw a big circle around that stick figure. What this does is divide the world into two parts. Someone who understands the world the way the stick figure does belongs inside the circle, next to the stick figure. People who don't understand the way the stick figure does, doesn't understand the challenge or the needs, belong outside the circle. Now, that stick figure is your prospect. To communicate effectively, your first job is to get in that circle. The challenge is this. If your prospects don't see you as belonging in that circle, they're not going to listen. Same with your students, with your clients. Whatever prospect means to you, your point of view will not be seriously considered. You'll remain an outsider with little influence. Outside, people are not going to really listen to you. To enter, identify your prospect's biggest challenge. Begin a collaboration. Resonate with that experience. Articulate the challenge or the pain points as clearly as you can. This moves you into the circle. Listen carefully. Identify the kinds of emotions your prospects feel. Then put yourself in their shoes and ask yourself why they're feeling that way. Their specific challenges. See what they see, feel what they feel, and then find some part of their emotional experience that you can genuinely resonate with. You have to resonate with your audience where they are and find a way to communicate that understanding before they admit you to that circle. Here's an example of how the circle technique works. It's a description by the Wall Street Journal of how Obama began winning presidential primaries, and people were puzzled about how he was charming voters in the heartland, where it was predicted that he wouldn't at all. Reporter Stephen Hayes followed Obama around and analyzed what he saw as his circle strategy. When he addresses a contentious issue, Mr. Obama almost always begins his answer with a respectful nod in the direction of the view he's rejecting, a line or two that suggests he understands or perhaps even sympathizes with the concerns of a conservative. He moves into the circle. Remember, that was Lincoln's approach to arguing a case. Hayes cited an example in which Obama was asked about the Second Amendment. He began his answer by saying that having taught constitutional law for 10 years, he believed that the Second Amendment granted individuals the right to carry guns, the conservative position, and that he respected the right of lawful gun owners to hunt and to protect their families. Only then, after he was in the circle, did Obama go on to talk about how he thought there should be new laws to help trace firearms used in crimes. At the end of his answer, Obama employed one final circle move, kicking his opponent out. He said, "The argument I have with the NRA is that they believe any constraint or regulation whatsoever is something they have to beat back. And I don't think that's how most lawful firearm owners feel." So Obama's left standing next to the lawful firearms owners, his audience, inside the circle, while the NRA has just been declared bereft of common sense, not like us, cast out of the circle. Winning means not only getting inside, it also means pushing your opponent out. Now, I'm not recommending that for professionals, but the circle vision suggests that to bring your audience over to your side, your first move should be to go where your audience is. Connect with the audience. Then you can move forward together. Here's a Girl Scout variation of entering the circle. Most Girl Scouts are taught to memorize a fairly complicated spiel, one that involves introducing themselves, talking in detail about the good work that the Scouts do, and finishing with how the money raised goes for great purposes. Now, this is tough work even for a professional, but for a kid talking to an adult stranger, can be kind of scary. Here's an alternative that more than doubles the sales rate. It's the question, what's your favorite kind of Girl Scout cookie? This initial question focuses our brains. We know that questions focus our brains. And the first few words determine a state of mind. In 10 words or less, all the nostalgic memories of cookies past are summoned in one simple question. The power and the transaction shift with the Girl Scout going from requesting to supplying. It's a question that avoids a no, a question that starts a conversation and a question that opens the door to emotion. Those are the kind of questions that create value and build careers. The experience from the buyer's point of view is an emotional connection to something that's been in his or her life since being a kid. There's a reason why they don't change flavors of those Girl Scout cookies, as well as positive reaction with a young person learning to speak up. Selling a state of mind far outpaces only selling Thin Mint cookies. Changing a strongly held belief has more to do with storytelling than with facts or logic. Storytelling is emotional and persuasive. Stories are more powerful than data because they allow us to identify emotionally with ideas and people. Otherwise, it may be disregarded or seen as outsiders. We tend to align with people who share our identity, even if the facts disagree. So, in the last 3 or 4 minutes, I thought we would have time for discussion, but I want to go over just a brief summary of what we've talked about to kind of bring it together in bullet style for us to review and reflect about Mindset Mastery Summary. People buy for emotional reasons and justify with logic. Emotions drive us, how we imagine we're going to feel. Find the emotional reasons for someone buying now, and then the logical reasons. The purpose of a conversation, written or spoken, is to find the prospect's needs and then mutually create conviction. And remember, conviction starts with you first, then the prospect. Selling is the transfer of emotion of someone who buys what they feel most certain they will get that they want. When two people interact, the person with the greater confidence will influence the other. Prospects have to buy for their reasons, not yours. Facilitate the prospect's conviction that they're going to get what they want out of your service or product by matching their core identity or value. Remember from the first seminar, we buy what we most identify with, and that can be shown on brain scan. You show a number of things. The one thing that resonates, activates that part of your brain having to do with identity, that's the one you're going to act on. Find the predominant emotional reason for buying. And remember, the client will translate it into logical reasons. For brain processing, do one feature at a time, not the whole list. Actually, one benefit at a time, not the whole list. The authentic connection and how you say what you say will make more difference than what you say. And finally, consistently focus on prospects' benefits, values, and avoiding pain. We have just a couple of minutes. I'm going to put us on discussion mode for any questions. Thoughts or comments or questions? Or clarification?
Dave, this is Lori Mackinac.
Hey, welcome, Lori. How are you?
I'm good. So great information as usual. I find that I get a cramp in my hands as I'm listening. So I guess one of my questions, the information is so comprehensive. It's so great. I'm trying to figure out in my mind, you know, how to process it all and apply it. One of the questions I have is, and I don't know how you'll answer this quickly, but it's to apply it in, like, newsletter marketing, email marketing, that kind of thing.
Okay. I would suggest that you think about your lowest hanging fruit, people who you already have a relationship with, because it's those people who you're going to have the best appreciation of what their specific challenges are, what their needs are, and that's how you can begin with your communication. When you begin and resonate with their challenge, challenge or their need, they're going to pay more attention. Remember from conversational intelligence, you engage someone and have a collaborative beginning in that way, and what that does is allow you, by knowing the people who you're writing to or communicating with, you know them and you know what their challenges are. Anytime I've ever written anything, from a white paper to an email to a book, I dictate it because that's the way I create, but I'm envisioning my intended audience. I am speaking to them, so it's important for me to know them, and that's what really works well for them. So as you think about that, think about what kinds of ways you're addressing what they want or need and how best you can do that, and continue to get feedback from them. Ask questions. Remember, a question, the reason that I didn't immediately give you an answer at the beginning of each of the seminars that I began with a quiz is that not giving an answer sustains engagement. And when you begin with asking a question, it engages somebody because it focuses and there's not a sense of closure. Look at my blog called The Zeigarnik Effect. And I know when I did the presentation in Boston, the workshop with you, I mentioned this. It's archived in my blogs. It's the only one with Zeigarnik in the title, Zeigarnik. But and what it shows is that what we know now in neuroscience, that when we ask a question, our minds and brains each want to bring closure. So we continually seek, we continually scan ways to find closure. So when you begin with a question, then you've engaged someone, and then you mutually come to an understanding of an answer to that, that your product or your service or simply your blog, whatever it is you're offering, may address. And as you're thinking about this, find ways to build your platform. That's the equity of the internet. Anytime you're thinking about developing something from your practice to products or services, when you're doing something on the internet, like a newsletter, a blog, whatever, find a way for people, when you set up a blog, for example, find a way to have people respond to your blog. Be sure and have something at the top right, usually, for somebody to sign up for your blog. When I started a blog and you've heard this story before, Laurie, when I started a blog, I was nudged by my last publisher, McGraw-Hill, to do a blog, because I didn't particularly want to do a blog, but they nudged me when Secret Language of Money came out to do a blog. What I found was that not only did I love it, and it became, you know, the essence of probably about 40% of the sequel to the Secret Language of Money, it's with my agent now, but that I got as many followers in the first 4 months as I did 4.5 years of doing a newsletter. And I got a nice following and did all the right stuff, you know, present white papers for people to sign up. A blog can go viral. And it's something that can be your continuing education. So write about what you most want to know. Develop a service or a product about what's going to most benefit you. That's how this series came about. It's the one thing that I knew I needed to learn more about, and I knew that I would get intrigued if I could apply some mind and brain science to the whole idea of marketing, persuasion, that whole mindset kind of stuff. And it turned out to be true, and that's why I'm sharing it with you. So I know we're over time, and that's a beginning. I hope that began, Laurie, to answer your question. Did it sort of get in the ballpark?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I guess I have one really quick question to add to that. Would you recommend using the story within the marketing? So if you're writing a blog, really incorporating story.
Always and first.
Okay.
It's my two-part answer. The blogs that I have received most responses to began with a story, and most of them began with a personal story. Not anything that got in the way of my point, but that kind of amplified it, and it was a way to talk to readers. Pick the next time you go to a bricks and mortar bookstore, go to the nonfiction section, whatever, business nonfiction, whatever. Go to the section, pull off five books that grab your attention, and look at the first chapter. Every one of them will begin with a story. Every first chapter of every book that's made it to that bookstore will begin with a story. That's how we engage the right brain of someone with a story. We explain what the points or the lessons are. We engage the left brain. It's balanced learning. That's why stories are so crucial. So, and that's one of the first things I did when I made my transition from 25 years of practicing psychiatry and psychoanalysis to mentor coaching, is my first mentor was a storytelling mentor, because I knew I need to do something more than just get in front of a group of shrinks and analysts to read a paper. I was right, and it took longer than I thought, but you know, absolutely yes on the story. I know we're over time. Thank you all very much. If you have any questions remaining, I want to respect our time. If you have any questions remaining, fire them off to an email. And we're going to talk in our final seminar about neuromarketing. So we're going to apply some more of these. And I have a couple of stories. So thanks very, very much for your attention and interest and responses. Bye now.
Thanks, Dave. Thank you.